let's open the Word, 1 Chronicles chapter 27. We're going to finish the book of 1 Chronicles tonight. King David turning over things to Solomon as we've been studying through this. And it has been shown to us again and again how David divided up all the groups of men to serve. The porters, those that kept the gates and kept the doors, you know, we saw them. We've seen the Levites as they've been divided up, those that would watch over the treasuries, the money, and just different assignments. You know, back in the previous chapter, the singers were broken up into groups, you know, we saw. And He-Man, remember him, great guy. He was a worship leader, and his kids became worship leaders, an awesome example. But then at the end of the chapter, it tells us there in verse 33, two, that his brethren, men of valor, now speaking about these officers and judges, it says that the men of valor were 2,700 chief fathers whom King David made rulers over the Reubenites, the Gadites, and half the tribe of Manasseh for every matter pertaining to God and the affairs of the king. The men of valor were those that were placed over the matters of the king. And this is important. Men of valor. Valor simply is that trait, that characteristic that is in some that will not turn and run when there's a conflict. That's what valor is. You know, you put the men of valor on the front lines, you put them on the wall of the fortress, because when the enemy comes and begins to attack that fortress, the men of valor will make a stand. They won't run away. They'll fight to the end, so to speak. So David put the men of valor over the affairs of his, just as this is true. If you're willing to make a stand for Jesus, to make a stand for him, he will use you, no doubt about it. If you're willing to say, I'm going to stand, I'm going to be a man of valor for the Lord, meaning I'm not going to run when there's conflict in the spiritual sense. I'm not going to grab this, you know, thing or that other deal and kind of dive into the flesh or dive into the world. I'm going to make a stand right here where I know the enemy's trying to get to me. I'm going to be a man of valor. Watch and see what God does with you if you're that kind of person, truly. And again, you'll need the Holy Spirit to accomplish that. But you have to be willing for the Spirit to empower you in order for you to be a man of valor, a woman of valor, to make a stand in that way. If you're willing, you will be put in charge of the affairs of the king. Awesome. Some people aren't interested in that, frankly. That this doesn't sound that hot to them. But if that sounds great to you, you want to be involved with the affairs of your king, then make a stand for Christ. You know, again, this doesn't mean that you stand on the street corner and smack everybody with your Bible as they walk by. You know, say, I'm making a stand for Christ. You know, bam, you know. it just means that when the enemy is coming, you do not turn tail and run. You make a stand. You armor up, as Ephesians 6 tells us. You put on the full armor of God, and you get ready to stand up. When he comes around, you don't run. You stand your ground and say, I'm not going anywhere. I'm not running into this situation here. I'm not going to run into that vice there, this habit, this addiction. I'm not doing it, see. Lord, help me by your Spirit to make a stand for you, and then use me for the affairs that you have. That's the way it works, guys. And that's what David did. Now, watch this. Verse 1 of chapter 27, now the children of Israel, after their number to wit, the chief fathers and the captains of thousands and hundreds and their officers that served the king in any manner of the courses, which came in and went out month by month throughout all the months of the year of every course were 24,000. We talked about this before, 24,000. There's that number 24 again. 24 is a significant number. We see there in the book of Revelation, the 24 elders, picturing the 12 tribes of Israel and the 12 apostles, if you would, the church and the Old Testament saints combined. Now, 12, if you are a numerologist of the scriptures, if you would, you will recall that 12 is a number of government. That's God's number for government. That's why there is 12 tribes and there is 12 apostles. 12 was a prevalent number. 12 and 12 is 24. I figured that out all by myself. 12 and 12, 24 means what then? It is the perfection, the completeness of God's government. So when you see 24 again in the scriptures, as we do in heaven, as we do in these particular stories, we see here that this is God's perfect, complete government being pictured. That's why there was always 24. Now, what this is saying is there was one captain for each month, okay? So each captain served for 1 month a year is all he had to serve. Pretty good deal, right? And then the other captains would come in month by month, it says here, and each captain was over 24,000 men for a month. So at any given time, David's army just right now is 24,000. However, if you wanted to call in the troops, so to speak, each captain could bring in 24,000. So there could be 288,000 men just like that if they needed to be. So organized again, for what purpose? Well, because David here, as a picture of Christ, organizes things so that the battle, if necessary, can be fought with efficiency, with power, with effectiveness. See, there's nothing wrong, folks, with being organized in this sense to fight the battles of the Lord. Meaning what? Meaning God's perfect way of doing it, the 24,000, if you would, is the way that he will orchestrate and do things. And if you're behind him in this, if you're with him on this, then you will find victory in it. Doing it God's way is always the victory way. Doing it your own way, you're on your own, you know. And people say, well, I don't know what happened. I just didn't do so hot here. I mean, I thought I was going to have victory. Well, were you doing it God's way? Were you praying that up? Did you really check in with the Lord before you? No, I just kind of did it. Well, that's the routine for a lot of believers, by the way. And again, what is it that you can find out about God's way of doing it? Well, it's in the Word. Studying the Word, folks, is how you know what God does, how he does it. And many times you'll find the will of God for you personally in the Scriptures. How often is it that you read something in the Word and you go, whoa, that spoke to me, right? I mean, I was wondering about that. I was questioning this. And there it is. Right? Now, if you weren't in the Word, you wouldn't have seen it. You wouldn't have known it. So often this happens. See, being in the Word is not a got to, it's a get to. I get to study the Scriptures to see what God says, and oftentimes he speaks to me directly, personally. It's a living book. It's living and powerful, and God speaks to me through it, speaks to you through it. But you have to get into it in order to do that and hear his voice, you see, to see what his will is. So keep that in mind. Now, over the next bunch of verses, it talks about who was over what in a bunch of names again. We're not going to take the time to go through all those, but I will take you down to verse 23. After it talks about all these guys that were in charge of all these princes and tribes and all the rest, which is, you know, you can read it at your leisure. But it says in verse 23, but David took not the number of them from 20 years old and under, because the Lord had said he would increase Israel like the stars of the heavens. Now, if you recall, the big downfall of David that was recorded in the Chronicles, none of his other sins with Bathsheba or Uriah were, but that sin of numbering the people was mentioned again, remember? It was a sin that was mentioned again in this particular study because it was the greatest sin David committed. He even admits this was a great sin. I sinned greatly against God. In what way? Not trusting him, not believing in him, not counting on him for victory, for power, for all the rest. He counted on the numbers of men that he had. Here, it says he counted them not. See, David's learning to do what? Learning to count on God again. Here he's organizing all these things. And again, keep in mind, he's doing this for his son Solomon. He's getting everything prepared. Everything's being readied for his son Solomon. And why is David going through all this work, all this stuff to get everything prepared for his son Solomon? Well, a couple of reasons we'll see. It's a picture for one thing. And we'll see that Solomon, as David will mention again in this chapter coming up, that Solomon was young and tender, kind of a wimp, really. Young, inexperienced, didn't really have it together. And David knew it. David saw it. However, Solomon was chosen by God. Now, this is another picture. Maybe you can already put it together. If not, I'll help you. But here's the deal. David's making lots of preparations, but here he's learning in the preparation he's making not to number the people, because the Lord had said, I will increase Israel like the stars of the heavens. And then Joab, the son of Zeruiah, began to number. He starts numbering the people. Remember, Joab was against the numbering of the people when David had sinned greatly. Remember? But here, Joab almost instinctually is going after the numbers again, because he figures David wants it. But he finished not, because there fell wrath from or for it against Israel. He remembered the wrath. Said, oh, yeah. Neither was the number put in the account of the Chronicles of King David. Not listed here. Why? They didn't finish the numbering. There's no number given because they didn't finish counting. What did they do? Well, they quit counting on the numbers and started counting on God. You can do that right now. You can be in the middle of counting your little things that you've got going on, you know. You can start counting on all the, well, I count on this, I got that going, I got this together, quit it. You got nothing. Let me just fill you in. We got nothing. Zero. What do we have? God Almighty. That's enough. You don't need to count anything else if you have the Lord. What more do you need? Let's see, I've got God, and then I've got a couple of little things over here. Who cares, right? If you've got the Lord, who cares what else it is that you have? That's the point. So they quit numbering because they didn't matter. It didn't matter to them any longer. Now, over the king's treasures was all these other guys and all the olive trees. I mean, they had things over everything. They had guys over all the camels. It says there in verse 30, flocks and all. I mean, there was guys over every little thing in David's kingdom. And you might look at these names and you can read through them again at your leisure and say, what's the significance of that? Well, there's lots of little jobs, isn't there? And why are these listed? Who cares who was over the camels? God. He cares. That's why it's here. Well, who would care who was over the olive trees? God did. He cared and still does. And all these little tasks are mentioned by name with men that were overseeing them, because God doesn't overlook anything or anyone, no matter how menial we might think the task is. You see, I bet you didn't know that Shitrai, the Sharonite, was over the herds, right? I bet you didn't know that. But God knows it. He's got him right here in the scriptures. Is your name in here? See, it's written in the book of life. But here's the deal. This guy, who is he? I don't know. But he's in here as one that was over the herds for David. Nice. A small task. But hey, he's mentioned because God appreciates everything that's done for him. Just as David here makes mention, hey, these are the guys that I had in charge of things. Be faithful with a few things, and you'll get many things to be over. That's what Jesus said. So, verse 1 of chapter 28 says this. David assembled all the princes of Israel and the princes of the tribes and the captains of the companies that ministered to the king by course, and the captains over the thousands and the captains over the hundreds and the captains over the stewards and the substance and possession of the king and his sons, with the officers and with the mighty men and with all the valiant men under Jerusalem. He gathers everybody together for this reason, to give counsel to the people and to his son. This is David's wrap up, if you would. He's getting ready. He's just about done. He's an old man, full of years, as we looked at, full of days. He had a full life, and his time is up. He's a very weak man. We saw that from a previous study. If you recall, David is really frail at this particular point. They couldn't get any warmth, remember? Remember that whole deal? They tried real hard to get him warm, but he couldn't get warm. Why? He's done, you know. His body was just without warmth. They put blankets on him and all kinds of things, and it did not warm him up. So he's frail and old here, but watch. He gathers all these people together, all these men and all these officers. Then David the king stood up upon his feet. Now that's significant. David had several postures we see him in throughout the scriptures. Bowed down, oftentimes in humility. Hands lifted in praise to God. And here he stood up in his last message, really, to the people and to his son, out of respect. David was a unique man. I mean, much as you might look at David and say, boy, he was a failure in so many ways. He was. But I'll tell you something. There wasn't a whole lot of men like David. David was a man who worshiped God, who bowed himself before a man like King Saul, who wanted to kill him. And with such humility, would never speak a bad word about a man like Saul who tried to kill him over and over and over again, but simply told his men, told the people that God was faithful and never said a bad word about Saul, ever. There's not a whole lot of people like David in this world. He is noted as a man after God's own heart for a reason. You know, again, failures, absolutely. But David had respect unto his son and unto his people. And he stands up in their presence. He doesn't have to do this. He's still the reigning king. And he could just sit there. He's tired. He's old. Must have taken everything he had to get up on his feet at this particular point. He couldn't even get warm. But he stands up on his feet and said, hear me, my what? Brethren. David speaks to the people as brothers. He doesn't call them subjects or servants. He says, brethren. Now, it reminds us of the greater than David, doesn't it? Jesus said, I no longer call you servants, but I call you what? Brethren. You're my brothers. See? And my people. And as for me, I had in mine heart to build a house of rest for the ark of the covenant of the Lord, for the footstool of our God, and had made ready for the building. David says, I really wanted to do this. This is, again, we've heard this before, but why is this so important? David here is going to make the confession again of his heart. He had a desire to build something for God. But verse 3 says, but God said unto me, thou shalt not build a house for my name, because thou hast been a man of war and hast shed blood. David's confession is, here's what I wanted to do. Here's what I was not able to do. I was not able to build a house for God. It's a confession. Why? Because my hands were bloody. I was a man of war, which apparently we look at David's life, he needed to be. But yet God said, because you have shed blood, because you're a man of war, you're not going to build my house. And this is what David confesses, why he couldn't do this. Sometimes we have to make confession, don't we? Why is it, guys, sometimes we can't do things? Oh, we may have the desire in some capacity. I want to serve God. I want to do this. I want to do that. And that's great. Just like God told David, that's very nice, David. That's great that you want to do that. However, you're not going to be able to. Why? Because you have blood on your hands. There's blood on your hands. Now, guys, this gets into some real interesting thoughts for me. My sin is absolutely forgiven. Yours too. Past sin, present sin, future sin. All of it's forgiven and forgotten as far as that goes. But there are things that I might be doing or have in my life that cause there to be blood or stains, if you would, that prevent me from doing certain things. Even though I might have a desire to do things, there might be stuff that keeps me from doing it. And sometimes I need to confess that. David here is, do you understand what David's doing here? He's standing up in front of every important person in Israel, plus all the people gathered together, plus anybody else that he could gather. And he stands up in their presence and says, I wanted to build a house for God. I wanted to do something noble, but I couldn't. Why? Because I'm bloody. I have blood on my hands. And he did, didn't he? Not only the blood of battle, but the blood of murder, the blood of adultery, all those things he had on his hands. And he could not do it. He's confessing before everybody. This is courageous stuff. To stand up and say, I would do this. I had the desire to do this. But, you know, frankly, I'm not able to do it because I've got this issue. I've got this issue. I've got this thing that's holding me up. You see. And David was instructed by God that this was going to be the way it was. It was going to have to fit the picture for David that God wanted to paint. And God said, that's the way it is. I'm going to make this so. Solomon is going to build me a house in a time of what? Peace, not war. David, you fought all kinds of battles, and you have won all kinds of battles for your son Solomon, but I'm going to use Solomon to build it, not you. And David has to be content with that. Difficult for him, you must know. God said, no, you're not going to do it. Howbeit, verse 4, the Lord God of Israel chose me. Now he says, but here's what he did do. He's not going to let me build his house, but he chose me before all the house of my father to be king over Israel forever. That's what he did do. For he hath chosen Judah to be the ruler, and the house of Judah, the house of my father, and among the sons of my father, he liked me to make me king over all Israel. Over everybody that he could have chosen, David said, he chose me. Wow. See, he makes a confession, but now he says, but let me tell you something, I'm not bummed. I'm not bummed because he chose me. He could have chosen anybody to do what he's having me do, but he chose me to do it. Do you guys know this is the same exact reality for you? Don't just look at David here and say, well, yeah, that's David. He got to be king of Israel. Hey, God has chosen you for the exact thing that he wants you to do. Out of all the people he could have chosen to do what you're doing, he chose you to do it. You say, well, I'm not like David. I don't have a life like King David. Doesn't matter. Your life is just as important to God as David's was. Just as important. And the thing that he chose you to do is just as important to him. Remember, he listed all the caretakers of the camels and the olive trees and, you know, whatever you're doing. You might not be king of Israel, but you might be taking care of the olive trees or the camels. You know, maybe you got a camel in your family or two. Maybe your husband looks like a camel or whatever. I don't know. But the deal is maybe you're taking care of that. Maybe you're dealing with some other thing, but it's just as important. He chose you. He could have chose anybody. David says, he chose me to do this. And of all my sons, for the Lord hath given me many sons, David said, he hath chosen Solomon, my son, to sit upon the throne of the kingdom of the Lord over Israel. He says, out of all my sons, the Lord chose Solomon. Now, it gives us an indication that David didn't necessarily choose Solomon, may not have even been David's choice, but the Lord chose him. And he said unto me, David hears from the Lord, Solomon, thy son, he shall build my house and my courts, for I have chosen him to be my son, and I will be his father. Important that you note what God just said right there. He will be my son, and I will be his father. This is important. I'll bring it up here in just a minute. Moreover, I will establish his kingdom forever if he be constant to do my commandments and my judgments as at this day. Now, therefore, in the sight of all Israel, the congregation of the Lord, and in the audience of our God, keep and seek all the commandments of the Lord your God, that you may possess this good land and leave it for an inheritance for your children after you forever. David hears from the Lord that Solomon is to do all these things, including this in verse 8, keep and seek all the commandments of the Lord your God. And this is something that you need to kind of think about, folks. And I bring it up because it slips our thinking sometimes. It gets away from us often. If God is your God, then his commandments should be your life. If he is your God, then the way that he speaks, the things he talks about, the things he is all about in his word and throughout what his spirit tells you and so forth, that should be your life. If God is your God, then his word should be your lifestyle. And here he says, now I want you to seek and to keep all the commands of the Lord so that you may possess this good land. So you can possess the promises, so you can possess those things. God wants us to possess every good promise, every good thing he could give us. But he knows that without the keeping and the seeking of his word, that won't happen. And I get so tired of this in myself. I get tired of it in you too. Here's the thing. I get so sick and tired of people saying, well, I don't know what to do. Yes, you do. I don't know what to do to live my life for Christ. Yes, you do. It's right here. Do what he says. Yeah, but I'm not sure. You know, if he says this or he says, stop it. He says it so clearly. Why don't we get honest and say, you know, I know exactly what he's saying, but I'm not doing it. No way. See, that doesn't sound good. That sounds bad. That sounds rebellious, doesn't it? That's what it is. See, we are rebellious. We just don't like to admit we are. We'd rather kind of play dumb, if you would. We'd rather say, I don't know what it means. I just don't know. You know, she do? Yes, we do. We know what it means. It means this: seek God, keep his word, and then enjoy his promises and possessions. That's what it means. Pure and simple. Whatever he speaks to you today, tomorrow, the next day, next week, just do that. Just do it. And David will say that here. It's interesting. He says this to Solomon. And thou, Solomon, my son, he says to him, know thou the God of thy father, and serve him with a perfect heart and with a willing mind. For the Lord searcheth all hearts and understandeth all the imaginations of the thoughts. If thou seek him, he will be found of thee. But if thou forsake him, he will cast thee off forever. Now, before you start thinking, if I don't seek the Lord, he's going to cast me off. This is pertaining to a specific duty that Solomon was called to do. What? Building the temple. If you will seek me, God was saying to Solomon, then you will obviously find what you're seeking for. But if you don't, then this particular task is not going to be for you. This isn't going to be. And once it's gone, it's gone. For how long? Forever. Once you pass up certain things God has for you, folks, do you understand this? That thing's gone. Well, how long is it gone for? Ever. Forever. You get a shot at something eternal, and God says, here's an opportunity. Today is today. You can't bring back yesterday. Yesterday's gone. Sounds like a song. It's gone. You can't bring it back. Those opportunities you had yesterday, you can't get them back, some of them. So here, God says, look, seek me. Keep doing these things that I'm asking you to do, and the opportunity that I'm giving you to build my house will be so. Don't, and it'll be cast from you for how long? Forever. It's gone. Missed opportunity. But here's what I want you to see. Solomon is told, know God, verse 9 says, and then serve him with a perfect heart. The key here is you can't serve God unless, of course, you know him, right? And if you try and serve him without knowing him, it will become a huge burden for you. This is what legalism does. And this whole idea that, well, I've got to get in there and serve God, you know, and people get in there and start sweating. Remember the whole deal with the linen and the wool that the priests were to wear? Remember? The priests, as they served in the tabernacle and in the temple, they weren't allowed to wear wool clothing. Why? Because wool's hot. Makes you sweat. And God said, I don't want you sweating like that when you're serving me. So wear linen or cotton, t-shirt material. Wear something light and cool so that when you're serving me, you're not sweating it out. I don't want you doing that. I want you to serve me in such a way that it's not this sweaty stuff. Because if you know me, the Lord is saying, then you can serve me. If you don't know me, then serving me is going to be a burden. And guys, people are serving God. Listen carefully. They're serving God thinking that they're doing something noble when really all they're doing is sweating and stinking. And God says, P.U. Whew. Wow. Somebody's reeking down there. Why? Because it's not done because they know him. It's done because they know of him and think that this is what he wants from them. This is a key. If I really have intimacy and know my God, I will serve him. How? Well, with a perfect heart, a willing mind. I will serve him in that way. I love my Lord, so I'm going to serve him. I'm not serving, oh, I got to serve God today. This is so tough. Well, keep your servants, God would say. Don't serve, if that's the case. Well, what about the sacrifice and all that that we're supposed to be? We're supposed to be living sacrifices, right? True. But who was the living sacrifice? Jesus. Jesus is the living sacrifice. He lives in me. Therefore, without him, I can do nothing. So any service I do truly that's of God is done by the Spirit of God in me, not by me trying to do something. I'm going to serve. The only sacrifice that I make is I lay down my life for him. He picks it up. This is what being willing in your mind is all about. If you do know him intimately, folks, you will serve him. If you don't know him and you serve him, it'll be sweaty and hot. So again, seeking his intimate relationship with you and cultivating that is the key to serving with a willing mind and a perfect heart, meaning a mature heart, a heart that's not grudging every time it has to do something, you know. And boy, Christians, you know, they're good at that. They're good at grudgingly serving. They're better at it than they are the other way of serving, which is cool and light and loving. Have you ever noticed somebody that serves with just this cool, loving attitude? They stand out, don't they? Why? Because more than not, it's not that way, even with Christian servants, so to speak. So here, the instruction to Solomon is, hey, this is what you're to do. You are to know God, first of all. Know him. Know him intimately. Then you can serve him with a perfect heart and a willing mind. See? And you serve him with everything that you have, all your heart, you see, because God searches the heart. He knows whether you're doing it for the right reason. And he understands all the imaginations of the thoughts. Ouch, that'll wake you up. He knows every thought, every imagination. You can't fool him. You can't say, well, I'll serve him, and I'll put a smile on my face. I'm really doing this with a right heart, Lord. He looks right into your heart and goes, sorry, see your heart. That's the shame of it, see. I can see right into your thoughts. So what does that mean? That means I serve him with my first fruits. That's what the first fruits was all about, folks. The best. The first of the best. The prime stuff. The cream off the top. Not the bottom of the barrel. I don't serve him with my leftovers, in other words. And some people think that that's totally acceptable, and I need to clear this up. It's absolutely not acceptable to serve God with your leftovers. Your leftover time, your leftover money, your leftover attitude, your leftover ability, whatever it might be. It is not okay to serve God with your leftovers. He gets the first fruits of my life, or he gets nothing. And if you give him the leftovers, it's as if you gave him nothing. You with me on this? He is the God of your salvation and my salvation. David here is instructing his son, make sure you give him the first, the best of what you have, not the least and the leftovers. And when you don't have anything left and it's scraping up off the floor, here, Lord, mustered up a smile and an attitude, okay, I'll be all right. You know, forget it. Well, what are you saying? We can't go to God with all these poor attitudes? Of course you can, and you do. And you will continue to do so. But here's the deal. I want you to see this, folks. This will change things for you, I believe. God deserves your best. And here's the problem with us most of the time. We don't think we have a best. So we just give him anything. But you do have a best. And you know what it is? It's the first. It's the first part. First part of your day. It's the first part of your attitude before it's trampled on. You know, I mean, for me, I have to spend time with God in the morning, because if I wait until the late night, all I have left is a bunch of rags in dirt and stuff. Here, Lord, here. It's like a dirtied handkerchief. Here, do you want it? And here's the amazing thing to me. He'll take it. He'll take it. But what we're reading about here is the right way, that he gets the best. Know him and serve him with everything you've got, because he knows your heart. He knows your mind anyway. Don't give him the last bit of your heart. Give him the first part. Now, take heed, verse 10. Now, for the Lord hath chosen thee to build a house for the sanctuary. Be strong and do it. This is, again, just exactly what I said. This is what Solomon heard that day. Look, you've been called to build a sanctuary for God. Now do it. Get out there and do it, Solomon. And that's sometimes what you have to tell yourself in the morning. Get out there and do it now. Get up. Get going. Go out there and do it. Do what?